brand new talk, so it's not as polished as it could be. So also, if there's any sort of condensed matter jargon leaking to the talk you don't understand, please ask, because I tried to gear this towards so that everybody could understand it pretty simply. So the main work I'm going to talk about is work I did with Rob Lee, who's a frequent visitor here at Water Refractin. And the secondary thing I'm going to talk about at the end is work I did with Andy Randono, who's in the audience as a postdoc here. So actually, it's kind of fitting that BJ Bjorkane is here, because a lot of the ideas that I'm going to talk about here sort of were initiated by his discussion with our group at Stanford. He was very lively talking to us about some work that Laurent Friedel did on the topological theory of gravity, and it sort of got us interested in studying these other torsional analogs of field theory anomalies. So the structure of my talk is going to be like this. So I'm first going to sort of introduce the notion of torsion, as you might see it in condensed matter systems. This is just sort of to build some intuition so you have an idea of what I'm talking about. The second part, I'm going to talk about how topological insulators, and I'll give some examples later, respond to torsional deformations in the system. And the third part I'm going to talk about is the work I did with Andy on new topological defects in 3+1 dimensions, which possibly could be observed in systems with strong spermova coupling. So let's begin with dislocations. So imagine I have this two-dimensional lattice, drawn these sort of lines of lattices here, and you see I have some regions which are undeformed, and I have some regions which have what are called crystal dislocations. So you can imagine dislocation is a deformation of the reference lattice by inserting sort of an extra half plane of atoms. So instead of sticking the entire plane in there, you sort of cut it off somewhere in the middle, and these sort of points here bend this lattice around them. And so these points, the red and the pink point here, are sort of what we call crystal dislocations. Okay. So these turn out to be sort of quantized sources of torsion in the system, and so I'll illustrate that in a moment. But you imagine what you have some reference lattice state, and around this reference lattice state, these things are deformed, and in this case, we have these two sort of topological defects. So let's illustrate how this gives you torsion. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a closed path in the reference state. So I'm going to move three steps to the right, three steps up, three steps left, three steps down. So this should give me a closed cycle in the reference state. And we're going to see how this works in the lattice. So let me start here far away from this dislocation. You see I go three right, three up, three left, three down. I don't see any problems. There's no discontinuity. So I get back to right where I started from. But now if I enclose the dislocation, I have a problem. So now when I go three right, three up, three left, three down, I actually don't end up where I started from. So I end up at some other point, shifted from the initial point. Okay? And so this is the sort of fundamental notion of torsion. It's when you go around some loop, instead of coming back to where you were, you get translated by some amount. So it's different from curvature, where if you go around a loop carrying an arrow, the arrow gets rotated at the end of the path. But here, you get a physical translation. So the actual translation, this distance here, is what's called the Burgers vector of the dislocation. So the amount you end up translated away is characterized by a topological charge. And the topological charge, there's several of them, which indicate how far away you're transported. That's sort of what the translation is. So for example, this dislocation carries a Burgers vector in the y direction. Okay, and if you continuously deform the lattice so this dislocation stays here, you can't change the Burgers vector. It's always a constant number fixed to be some quantized amount of lattice constants. So for every dislocation that's associated with this Burgers vector, the Burgers vector tells you that when you wrap around it, how much you get translated. This is very similar to saying if you have a magnetic flux and you drag your particle around a magnetic flux, you get some phase in your wave function. The phase tells you how much flux you're holding. So here, this dislocation carries a vector of fluxes, basically. It's convention. So you basically say that you make a convention whether you're going to travel around this guy left-handed or right-handed, and whether this guy points this way or that way depends on how you define your path around. But it's always in this direction. It's always in the y direction. But whether it's pointing that way or that way depends on the sign convention you choose. So yes, that's a good question. So. The true dislocation is this point. This string here is an artifact. Okay, so it's just like saying a magnetic flux line carries a Dirac string, something like this. This path going back is just a way to draw it in a certain gauge, effectively. So you can do local deformations of the lattice so that this point stays here, but this string gets mixed or something as the string goes off. So you can deform that string in some way, which doesn't change the Burgers vector. That's why it's topologically stable. But a dislocation is in 2+1D is a point defect. In 3+1D, it's a line. So it's this sort of vortex-like in this case. OK, so let's make this analogy with magnetic flux a little bit clearer. So you imagine you have some electron and some magnetic flux line penetrating your plane. You're going to drag your electron around this flux. And when you do this, it picks up an Aronoff foam phase. It basically says that the amount of flux enclosed changes the phase of your wave function as you go around the loop. Right? Okay, so now if you imagine this is a crystal dislocation, so this point sitting this plane is like my dislocation point. Okay, and what you do is now as you translate around, instead of giving you this U1 phase, it actually gives you a translation operator instead. So this is just sort of the generalization. Instead of giving you some U1 phase, it gives you this translation, which is e to the I, the momentum of the state, times the Burgers vector in this case. So it's a physical translation in space as you go around it. Okay? So this turns out to be only equivalent to a phase if the state you're acting on is a momentum eigenstate. So you can see how this translation operator acts on any wave function, which depends on position. You can Fourier transform your wave function. You see that this translation operator just shifts every plane wave, basically. So the only time when it acts as a true phase, like this U1 phase, is when you only have one plane wave. But basically, it's an eigenstate of momentum. Okay? So basically, if only one of these five p's is non-zero, then you see this thing acts just like a U1 phase, except it's a phase given by the product of the momentum with the Burgers vector translation. Okay, so now let's take this analogy a little further. So we want to see how much phase we actually get in the U1 case. So what we have is we have this magnetic field given by the curl of the vector potential. And you can see the phase is simply equal to this Wilson line around the flux. So you take the integral around this loop, multiply by the charge here, and you find out that the phase you get is the 2 pi times the number of flux quanta in the system. So the flux can actually be fractional, so you could have 0.1 flux quanta, 0.2, or whatever else, and this shifts the phase. So actually, when you insert a full flux quantum, the phase is just e to the 2 pi I, which means the particle doesn't see the flux. So for some little bit of flux, it actually picks up the phase. So you get something similar if you think about dislocation. So in this case, instead of getting a single magnetic field, you actually get several of them indexed by this letter A. And the sort of magnetic field for dislocations, the sort of flux, is given by the curl of this quantity EA, which is a vector potential for translations, basically. And so in gravity, you would say this vector E is the sort of frame field, or in this case, I'm in 2 plus 1, so it would be a triad field. So this analogy is clear. This E is some set of vectors labeled by index A. So now what you do is you simply can do the similar thing, except now instead of the charge being a constant, E, the charge is actually the momenta. So each wave function has a different charge, and it depends on its momentum, and you dot the PA into the EA index, and you find out that if you look at this integral of EA around this loop, you get this quantity. Okay. So this means that E somehow is not single value, just like this flux argument here, there's some issue there, and so you actually, as you travel around this loop, you pick up a translation. Okay. So for the magnetic field case, we have the vector potential. For the dislocation case, the torsion case, we have this frame field. And so these two things you should keep in mind as an analogy in this case. Okay, so one crucial difference which makes these things not analogous, which is going to be important in the second part of my talk, is the actual dimensions of these units. So in natural dimensions, the vector potential has units of mass, or 1/length. But the frame field actually has no units, so it's actually dimensionless. Okay. So this quantity E mu A has no units, and this is going to be important when I talk about the response of these topological insulators to torsion later on. Okay, so now let me illustrate some of these concepts with this 2 plus 1 dimensional topological insulator. So a topological insulator can be modeled minimally by a massive Dirac equation. So no matter what dimension you're in, you can write down a massive Dirac equation, and in a sense, this gives you a way to model what's called a topological insulator. And so for those of you who don't know, a topological insulator is nothing but a system with a mass gap. Okay, so it's a system that's insulating, inert in the bulk, but on the boundary it has some gapless propagating modes. Okay, so if you're familiar at all with something like the quantum Hall effect, which is insulating in the bulk but has chiral edge states running around the boundary, this is an example of a topological insulator. But generically what you get is you find that what these insulators are is they're systems which have a Dirac mass which is negative in some sense. Okay, so what you find is that So I'm going to illustrate this in a minute. But if you solve the energy spectrum of this 2x2 Hamiltonian, you find it's just p squared plus m squared, the Dirac mass in 2 plus 1d. Okay? So this spectrum doesn't care about whether the mass is positive or negative. So by itself, this system, you can't tell whether the mass is positive or negative. You don't know. And so what you have to do is actually compare it to something with the opposite sign. Okay? So you imagine that you take an interface between a mass greater than zero system and a mass less than zero system, and you have a domain wall in the mass. Right? So Jakeev and Rebbe solved this problem in 1974 or 1976 for a one-dimensional system. They find something that generalizes to any Dirac equation. When you have a kink like this in the mass, you always get a zero mode bound to this interface. Okay? So what this means is that here, where the mass is greater than zero, the system's gapped. Here, mass is less than zero, it's gapped. This is the spectrum. But here, it actually passes through zero, so there's a chance you could have some low-energy modes sitting right at the kink. Okay? It turns out you always do, and this low-energy mode's localized. Okay? So but now we have this extra transverse direction. It's not just 1 plus 1d, it's 2 plus 1d. And so you actually get to see this mode disperses along this line. It actually disperses only in one direction. So for the 2 plus 1-dimensional Dirac equation with a negative mass, you get actually a chiral edge state if you interface it with a system with a positive mass. So you put m greater than 0 next to m less than 0, and you get this chiral state on the interface. So the sort of model for a topological insulator is you imagine that this is the bulk of your insulating system. This is your material, and this is a trivial vacuum outside. So in some sense, a topological insulator is nothing but a material which has a Dirac mass opposite to that of the vacuum outside. Okay? So that's a bit of a heuristic picture, but that's sort of the idea you're supposed to keep in mind, that the reason this state is interesting is because it's interfacing between these two systems, and there's some gapless states in the boundary. So the bulk looks inert. The boundary has gapless states on it. Okay, so this is all the physics of topological insulators in any dimension. This is how it works and how you get the edge states. Okay, so as I said, the bulk is described by some massive fermion field. The boundary fermion is described by, in this case, a chiral fermion, where the degrees of freedom are cut in half. Okay, so in the bulk, what you have some Dirac fermion, on the boundary you have chiral fermions. The dimensions cut in half. Right. So what happens is the bulk, the topological structure of the bulk, effectively takes the right-handed chiral fermion and the left-handed chiral fermion and puts it on two different surfaces. So it takes the full Dirac fermion and rips it apart and spreads it to two different surfaces. So on this single edge here, you only have half the degrees of freedom as you have in the bulk.
In every other dimension, in other words, the next one up where this works would be 4 plus 1 and then 6 plus 1 and so on.
So it generalizes there, but it also generalizes in 3 plus 1d.
Pardon?
It also generalizes to 3 plus 1d. So, of course,
you can also do it in 3 plus 1.
Yeah, the app description is skipping two dimensions, but you can also do it in 3 plus 1d, but there you don't get chiral fermions on the boundary. So you only get chiral fermions when you're looking at an odd-dimensional space-time, the boundary of an odd-dimensional space-time, because that way the boundary is even-dimensional. Okay. So in 3 plus 1d, you don't get chiral fermions on the boundary, but you do get special types of gapless fermions.
And they're confined to the boundary.
Confined to the boundary, that's right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now let's take this quantum Hall system, which is this topological insulator. I haven't described why it's topologically insulating, what it has a quantum Hall effect, but I can tell you that now. So if you take this massive Dirac equation and you calculate the response to an external electromagnetic field, what you find is if you calculate this sort of linear response, which you get by calculating this current-current correlation function of this bubble diagram, you see there's this Chern-Simons term. Okay, so this Chern-Simons term, if you calculate the current by taking the functional derivative of S effective with respect to A, you see it gives you two different pieces. You get a spatial current when you have an electric field, and you get a charge density when you have a magnetic field. This is all the Chern-Simons term is telling you, basically. Okay? So for many, many condensed matter systems in two plus that are confined to 2 plus 1 dimensions, you can calculate this type of term. But for most systems, the coefficient n is 0. Okay? It turns out for any actually non-interacting system in 2 plus 1d, this coefficient n is actually quantized to be an integer, which is known as the Hall conductance. Okay? And for most systems at 0, it turns out for the massive Dirac equation with a negative mass, it's actually equal to 1. So the massive Dirac equation is one model, which gives you a non-zero Chern-Simons response. Okay? And so we can see this in pictures by just drawing, you know, if you apply an electric field, you get some current perpendicular to it. This is this equation. This is the Hall effect. If you insert a magnetic flux here, how do you understand this equation? Well, if you start threading a magnetic flux to the system, you have a time-changing flux, and so you get the Faraday effect, which means you have a circulating electric field. So the circulating electric field is traveling around this loop. But now you have an electric field, so you have this Hall response. So now the circular electric field generates a current radially because of the Hall effect. And so now you get charge pumped to this this flux line. And so so these equations are very simple to understand. It says when you have an electric field, you get a current. When you have a magnetic flux, you get a charge. And that's all that's happening. Okay? And like I said, it turns out for the system, this is called the quantum Hall effect because this number that sits in front of this current is actually quantized in these units of E squared over H. Okay. So now I'm going to talk about bound states in this Dirac equation. But I'm going to do this on a lattice. I'm actually going to take my Dirac equation and put it on a lattice, which you can do. You can regularize it. I'm not going to write down the Hamiltonian, but effectively what happens is you put it on a lattice, and the low-energy theory reduces to the continuum Dirac equation. And what I'm going to imagine is I have this two-dimensional system. This is sort of just a piece of my topological insulator. This is my two-dimensional lattice. And I'm going to show how you get bound states on fluxes. Okay? So I'm going to insert a magnetic flux in the system in here. And I'm going to show how you get a bound state on it. And this is going to be interesting because I'm next going to use the analogy of how you can get bound states on torsional defects and crystal dislocations. So this is a quantum Hall effect. So if I cut these bonds, Now I'm effectively making a physical edge between this and the vacuum. Okay? So I cut all these links, and now this is an edge of a quantum Hall system interfacing the vacuum. This is the other edge, and so you get chiral states on this edge and chiral states on that edge. Okay? So I've cut the system, I've created an edge, I get edge states. So the low energy theory of these edge states simply means you have a chiral fermion and an anti-chiral fermion, and they're not coupled together. So this is the Hamiltonian, Py minus Py. Okay? So I'm going to do something interesting. I'm going to now start gluing these bonds back together, but I'm going to do it with a twist, basically. So I'm going to glue this back together. This adds a coupling between the chiral and anti-chiral fermions, because now they can hybridize together. So this gives you a term off-diagonal. So this actually opens a mass gap for the chiral fermions on the edge. You see, if I glue all these things back, I destroy the edge, so it has to go back to having no chiral fermions. So if I glue them all back, it opens a mass. So now I'm going to keep gluing these things back until finally I'm going to do something different. So these things all have the same amplitude, the same bond strength. But here I'm going to do something different. I'm actually going to switch the sign of this coupling for all further bonds, all the way out to infinity or the edge. So what effectively you have is you have a mass for these chiral fermions, which depends on this y direction. So here I have some amplitude for the mass, m. But what I'm doing here is I'm switching the sign of the mass across this point. Okay? And when I do that, I get a one-dimensional domain wall on the mass, which traps a bound state. So it's the exact same physics we saw before. It's just I'm doing this with this edge state. All right? Now, the important thing is that doing this weird flipping of this coupling here is the same thing as inserting a magnetic flux in the system. Okay? Because the magnetic flux couples to these bond variables, these links. And so what you get is that if you now enclose this plaquette by taking a line around it, you always pick up this extra minus sign when traveling across this point. And that's like picking up an extra phase. So if I actually, instead of flipping the sign, I multiply it by complex phase, this is saying like you have some flux in here. Okay? So this is a way to take a Dirac equation, 2 plus 1d, insert a flux into it, and get a bound state. Okay? And this bound state is some zero mode. This is just a lattice way to visualize what's going on. Okay? The flux is coming out of the plane. So every time you encircle this quantity, you pick up this this Wilson line across this bond, which picks up a phase in this case.
Would that make any effect at all?
No, all that does is changes the global boundary conditions of the system. So now what you've done is you've created two fluxes and dragged them all around and annihilated them. So now you've got to change the boundary. Now every time the particle goes through that point, it picks up a minus sign, so it changes it from like periodic to anti-periodic. It's like inserting a flux to the whole of the core. Okay, So now I want to do the same type of picture, but I'm going to talk about the crystal dislocations. And this is a picture developed by this Berkeley group. So I'm going to cut the system again, and I'm going to start gluing these bonds back together. But now, instead of putting a flux here, I'm going to insert a dislocation. Okay? So now I've inserted some shift. So now it looks like this set of atoms here is an extra half plane compared to the lattice. So this is my crystal dislocation point right here. Right? So everything else matches up across, except this guy ends here. Right? And so now these bonds are going to be connected in this weird way. Right? So what happens here? What happens here is different than what happens in the flux case. So now you see that this mass is the same sign here. This mass here is the same sign. It didn't change the bond sign, but something else is happening. What's happening is now as you go from here to this point, you're actually translating in the y direction by one lattice constant. Okay? So every time you go through this line, here nothing happens, no translation, the mass is the same, no translation. All of a sudden here, everything's translating by one unit. Okay? So what that means is that you pick up a phase on this bond, but it's not due to a flux, it's actually due to a translation. So you pick up the mass in the y direction depends on this Burgers vector and the momentum of the state. So in fact, a state which is traveling through here at zero momentum doesn't see the dislocation, doesn't get translated, or doesn't see get picked up a phase. But the phase of this mass term through here depends on the momentum of the state, and B is the Burgers vector of this dislocation. So this Burgers vector here is one unit in the y direction, and so this mass phase depends on momentum in the y direction. Okay? Now the point is you only get a bound state if the mass switches signs, so if the phase is minus one. So there's actually only going to be one momentum state, and it's not going to be the p equals zero state, which picks up this minus sign. So for the normal Dirac bound state, it's actually the momentum equals zero state, which becomes a zero mode. But here what's going to see is that this coupling here becomes like a momentum-dependent mass, and only one momentum, in fact, the momentum which gives you a pi phase, will actually become the bound state in this case. So we're going to see this sort of dichotomy between the flux, which actually acts on all particles the same, and torsion, which acts on systems differently if their momentum is different. So torsion is effectively like some kind of flux which depends on the momentum of the state, because the momentum is basically the charge. And all particles have a normal electric charge, but for torsion, it's the momentum which becomes the effective charge in these cases. Okay. So with that sort of introduction to some ideas about torsion, I'm now going to talk about what's called the topological viscosity. Okay. So since continuum mechanics is not often taught, at least in the United States, I'm not sure if it's taught in Canada, I'm going to give you a brief, very brief overview. So this is not something I knew beforehand and had to sort of like, you know, read Landau and Lischitz to understand because they don't teach it in graduate school in the United States. So I'm going to begin with some reference states. You see, I keep saying reference state over and over again. So to really talk about torsion, it's clear you have to have some reference configuration. Okay, and so I have some reference configuration here. This is my location of all my atoms. And I'm going to now imagine deforming them in some way. So I'm going to take all my atoms and shift them away. Okay. So what this means now is so this generates what's called a displacement field. So it means at every point in my lattice, I now have a vector, which tells me how far the atom was displaced from that point. So it's a position-dependent vector, which is called the displacement. And I have, so here at this point, I have this vector which translates me here, given by u at this position. Here at this point, I have a vector which translates to there, which is given by u at this position. So this is the same type of language used in hydrodynamics, where sort of particle elements get moved in time, and they're moved by some amount, which is the displacement. Okay, so this is, so if this system is an elastic medium, if there's some reason these things are held together, then this displacement will generate some kind of stress in the system, okay? So you get some stress tensor, which is proportional to gradients of this displacement field. So U is the displacement field, and this UKL is called the strain tensor, and it's actually proportional to gradients of the displacement. So you see that no stress is induced if you have a constant deformation across the whole system, because that means you're translating the entire crystal. But if you have relative displacements, you know, they depend on position like they do here, then you can actually get stress in the system, okay? So what we have here is the stress is related linearly to the strain tensor by the elasticity coefficients, which is this lambda tensor, which is a four-index tensor. And it's also related linearly to the strain rate, the time derivative of the strain, by what's called the viscosity tensor, okay? So the viscosity is nothing but the coefficient which tells you how much stress you get when you deform as a function of time. Okay, that's what the viscosity means. It's like a momentum-dependent force, right? That's what you learned about friction. That's what viscosity means. It means it's a force which depends on velocity and momentum. Okay, so if you want to think about these things in terms of gravitational variables, you can sort of linearize the frame field. So the frame field is going to be equal to this sort of orthogonal frame plus some deformation, W mu A, which in elasticity theory is called the distortion tensor. Okay. This U?
This is the strain tensor.
That's the strain tensor.
Right.
So the point is that this W mu A is nothing but the derivative of this displacement with respect to the coordinates. Okay. So basically, the frame field is nothing but a shift of the normal orthonormal frame by this distortion tensor. And you see that the stress in this case depends on the symmetric combination of this quantity. Right. And you can understand why this is true, because the metric, which is the square of this frame field, actually only feels the symmetric combination of these guys. So if you actually see what the elastic metric is derived from this frame field, you see it only depends on the symmetric combination of this distortion tensor, which means that the metric really is sensitive to the strain field. Okay, and this is why the stress tensor, which should be related to a functional derivative with respect to the metric, depends only on the strain here. Okay, and this is how it works in what's called classical elasticity. So classical elasticity means your point particles, your point objects, don't care about local orientation, okay? So we're going to see that for Dirac fermions, that's not true. Dirac fermions, your local fluid elements depend on the orientation because there's spinners attached. But for classical elasticity, when you have these bodies, these point particles, they don't care about orientation. It's called the
distortion tensor.
That carries the same information as the U strain.
It does, that's right. But it carries more information, actually. It carries more information. So if you can also define what's called the rotation tensor, which is the difference between these two quantities. And that has to do with rotation. That's also contained in this guy, but not contained in the strain. The strain is symmetric, that's right. Uh-huh. This is the difference of looking at things. So, for example, if you think about the stress tensor as a functional of the metric, okay, you'll never see things associated to like Dirac spinner things. So that means that the sort of metric formalism can't be coupled to fermions in the right way. If your local fluid element, your local spinner depends on the orientation, which it does, like you have a spinner at every point, so it depends on how you're rotating locally, then you really have to consider the sort of frame field structure, which has both the symmetric part and the anti-symmetric part in this case. Okay, So now I want to say, okay, can I take my response, which is my Tij, and write that in terms of some free energy, some effective action, okay? So I had some response, and I'm going to try to write this as some quadratic action. So now if I want the stress energy tensor, which I had in the previous slide, I just take the functional derivative of this guy with respect to Uij. So if I do that, you see I get lambda ijkl ukl plus the viscosity term, right? There's a subtlety here, okay, which I'll tell you in a second. So if you're talking about an isotropic system, and let me specify now the 2 plus 1d because I'm going to talk about quantum Hall, there's actually only two types of tensors you can write down for the viscosity term. Okay, so let's ignore, I'm not going to talk about elasticity anymore, I'm going to talk about viscosity. So you have the shear viscosity and the bulk viscosity, okay? And you see that these guys are actually symmetric if you exchange the ij indices with the kl indices, all right? But this is a problem, because now if you integrate by parts and put the time derivative on the first term, you can exchange the indices together and show that this term is equal to the negative of itself if the indices are symmetric. And so this term vanishes identically in the action. So if you try to write down the viscosity term in an action like this with these isotropic terms, you find out you cannot do it. And this makes sense because the viscosity is actually dissipative. So you shouldn't be able to represent any type of dissipative, you know, heat transport or anything like that through an action of this form. Okay? So this means that you can't get the viscosity from an action in this case, right? So it turns out there's actually one exception to this, right? So there's actually, in 2 plus 1, there's actually one more tensor you can write down. And this tensor, instead of being functions of only the deltas, actually depends on the epsilon tensor as well, okay? So I'm only talking about spatial components, which is why in 2 plus 1D, I only have two components for my epsilon tensor, okay? But this is one more term you can write. And in fact, this term is actually anti-symmetric under the exchange of indices. So this term does not identically vanish. And so this term actually can be represented by an action, right? It turns out this type of viscosity term is what I'm interested in. This term here is non-dissipative, and I'll show you why this is in a minute. And it's been called the quantum Hall viscosity or the odd viscosity. And to be non-zero, it actually must have time-reversal symmetry breaking. It's like the same thing as saying having a quantized Hall conduction system. You must break time-reversal. So for fluids which have no magnetic field, no magnetization, these are the only two isotropic viscosities you get. If you add a magnetic field, you can get an analog of like the Hall effect, which has to do with this type of viscosity. Okay, so now let's look at this action where now my eta ijkl is this topological viscosity, this sort of term I'm writing down here. So this is my action. Okay, so it's uij time derivative ukl with this tensor. And, but this is the tensor I'm using here. And if you try to look at the units of what the coefficient eta 3 must be, you find out this thing has units of h bar over l squared. Okay? So the, like I said, this unit thing will become important later, and I'll talk about that more later. But these units, h bar over l squared, were in 2 plus 1d, so this is equivalent to momentum density. H bar, momentum, l squared is the area, so density. It's equivalent to momentum per unit length, so momentum is h bar over l, and then I have an extra 1 over l, so it's momentum per unit length. And it's also the units of dynamic viscosity. So if you look up Wikipedia, look up dynamic viscosity, these are the units of dynamic viscosity. Okay, h bar over l squared. All right. So the important thing is that there actually are fluids where this quantity is known to be non-zero, and one of them is in the quantum Hall effect. So recently, there's been some papers which have begun discussing this in terms of the quantum Hall effect. And in that case, the length scale, which enters the quantum Hall effect, is the magnetic length. It's the length scale associated to the magnetic quantization size in the system. So if you have a huge magnetic field in your system, what happens is that in quantum mechanics, the actual system becomes non-commutative in real space, because your normal translation operators now pick up terms which are proportional to the magnetic field, and you see the translation operators do not commute any longer, and so you actually get some non-commutative geometry, and the scale over which your system becomes non-commutative is exactly this length scale, the magnetic length in the quantum Hall effect, okay? So it's known to be non-zero for the quantum Hall effect, which is this two-dimensional system with a huge magnetic field. We know one other system which has a quantum Hall effect, and that's the massive Dirac equation. So now I'm going to say, let me go to the case with the massive Dirac equation, which I described earlier, and see what the viscosity is in that case. We expect it to be non-zero. Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's coming up, yeah.
Uh-huh. You can write that only in 2 plus 1, right? Or this?
That's right, you can write it only in 2 plus 1. That's right.
So it's if you can write an anisotropic term in 3 plus 1, which is like extending Chern-Simons anisotropically to 3 plus 1d, but you can only write this term in 2 plus 1d. That's right. Okay, so now I'm going to talk exactly what Alyosha asked. Why is it non-dissipative? So imagine I have some blob of this two-dimensional fluid, okay? And I'm going to do a fluid dynamics experiment. So this system here, let's say, has a shear viscosity and has this topological viscosity. So I'm going to stick a solid cylinder into the middle of this fluid, and I'm going to begin to rotate it, So I'm going to spin this, start spinning this disk in the center. Okay. So now you think if this is fluid like water or oil or like honey or something like that, this disk is going to start feeling friction. You're going to be twisting it. You're going to feel it's harder and harder to twist it. And so you're actually feeling the shear viscosity acting on this disk. And so what you get is you get a force tangential to the motion. It's actually going against the disk. So this is actually the dissipative shear viscosity. It's stopping you from twisting it. It's giving you friction. It's causing you to do more work. So the topological viscosity actually does something different. When you rotate it, the force is actually perpendicular to the motion. So it actually tries to compress the fluid around the disk or expand it in some sense. Okay? It's very much like the Lorentz force. If you try to push something in one direction, the force is perpendicular. So it's like the magnetic field does no work. The same thing here, you get this non-dissipative viscosity, and it's very closely connected with like the like Lorentz force type of structure. So in this case, it's non-dissipative because the force is perpendicular to the motion. Okay, so now how can you calculate this? So I'm going to calculate this for my massive Dirac model in 2 plus 1D. And this is not a simple calculation to do, but basically what you do is you can take your Dirac action and couple it to gravity, and you do this by coupling to this frame field, which we talked about earlier, and something I didn't talk about earlier, except considering real flat space, which is the spin connection. So you have this covariant derivative, which has a connection, and you have this frame field. And so this is your Dirac action coupled to gravity in 2 plus 1 dimensions, right? So what we want is the viscosity. And to do that, we want to calculate the analog of the current-current correlation function. So we calculate a stress-energy tensor bubble diagram, which is going to give us this sort of linear response to deformations of this frame field. Okay? So what you find, if you do this carefully, is you find this. You find the topological mass term, which this is called the gravitational Chern-Simons term. Okay? So you find omega wedge d omega, which is the spin connection, plus 2/3 omega cubed. Right? So in most theories of gravity, this gives a mass to the graviton in 2 plus 1D, which is called the topological mass. So it's an alternative to the Higgs mechanism in 2 plus 1D. Right? So it turns out that for Dirac equation, if you do this carefully, you find actually another term as well. Okay? And so you find this term here, which depends on the frame field, and TA, which is the torsion 2 form. Okay? So the torsion 2 form is defined as the exterior derivative of E with respect to the connection. So you find these two different terms. Okay? And so I've labeled this term eta 3 on purpose because this is going to be actually the viscosity term. Right? So how can we, what's a heuristic way to think about this? Well, omega without torsion is effectively like one derivative of the metric. Okay? So this term here, omega d omega, actually is three derivatives of the metric, so it is units of 1 over length cubed. When you multiply it by the integration measure, that gives you that this quantity here is unitless, and so its coefficient is dimensionless, just like the Hall conductance for normal Chern-Simons. This term, however, is different. So E has no units, and torsion actually has units of 1 over length. So when you multiply by the integration measure, the integrand has units of length squared, and so to cancel it out, you see the coefficient has to have units of 1 over length squared in this case, right? So this coefficient, again, is going to have units of viscosity like we talked about earlier. Okay. So there's actually another cute way to calculate this, which I'm going to discuss quickly because it's interesting before I actually talk about what this viscosity means. So for gap systems, systems with mass gaps, you can actually calculate these topological responses a different way. So you have your ground state, and if you deform parameters very slowly, you can actually see how the system responds through what's called adiabatic transport. Okay. So one example is if you want to calculate conductivities of the system, you want to calculate how much current responds to the electric field, you can take your quantum system on a torus and look at the ground state. And you see how the ground state changes when you actually thread flux through these different non-trivial cycles of the torus. This is a two-dimensional torus that's hollow in the center. Right? So why does this tell you about electric current? It tells you about electric current because when you turn on the flux, you get the Faraday effect. So the Faraday effect actually generates a circulating electric field. So turning on phi 1 generates a circulating electric field, and so that would tell you how the current will respond to electric fields going in the x direction, for example. Okay? So this gives you a way to sort of twist boundary conditions or calculate the Hall conductance this way. Right? So how do you calculate the viscosity? So to calculate the viscosity, what you do is instead of deforming the amount of flux to the holes of the torus, you instead deform the modular parameter of the torus. Okay? So your quantum Hall system exists on a torus. You slowly tune this modular parameter around, which is like a shear deformation of the system. And this allows you to extract this correlation function, which is the sort of Hall viscosity. So deforming this tau parameter actually changes the form of the metric. And this actually, in this case, it's shear deformation, so it keeps the volume the same. But if you look at small deformations of the ground state due to deformation of this modular parameter, you can extract the viscosity. Just like if you thread these fluxes, you can actually calculate the conductivity by looking at the ground state and how it changes. So this is sort of a geometric deformation, which gives you a way to calculate the viscosity. Okay. So this term, which I'm calling this term here, is what's going to be the topological viscosity term. So it's actually this term which gives you this analog of the viscosity, right? So I'm going to consider flat space. I'm going to pick a gauge with the spin connection vanishes to simplify my notation. And so I'm left with this Chern-Simons term for the frame field. Okay? We can compare this to quantum Hall. We see we have the same structure, okay, with this Chern-Simons term, except we have these extra indices A and B, which are going to be carried along normally. Right? And if you compare the coefficients, like I said before, this coefficient has to have units of 1 over length squared, whereas this guy does not. ADAB, thank you, is the flat space Lorentz metric, minus 1, 1, 1, 1. Okay? It's because, so it's the metric which dots the frames into each other, which are orthonormal in Lorentz space. Right? So in this case, you have a set of U1 vector fields, and they're dotted into each other, projected. Okay? So now, if you calculate the viscosity for the Dirac equation, you find the following form. Okay? So A to 3 is proportional to the mass of the Dirac equation squared times h bar times the sine of the mass. And so this is, can be defined to be h bar over length squared. Length squared is given by the mass of the Dirac equation, right? So this term actually is odd under time reversal, because if I flip the sine of the mass, the sine of A to 3 changes. And so this thing here is, like I said, odd under time reversal, only exists when time rules are broken, so mass is non-zero, and it has some length scale in it in this case. Okay, so now what does this thing actually mean? So what we can do is we can take that topological viscosity action and calculate the stress tensor from it, just like we took the Chern-Simons action and calculated the current from it. Okay, so when you do this, you see you get the stress current, which tells you how much momentum with component in the A direction is traveling in the I direction. And you see this thing is simply equal to this curl, or in this case, it's this time derivative of the E field, or the gradient of the time component of the E field. So this is equivalent to saying that this is basically the response to a torsion electric field, okay? So it says that the current, in this case, the momentum current, is equivalent to the momentum current travels perpendicularly to the torsion electric field, right? Now, the other component, which tells you where the momentum density sits, is actually proportional to the curl of the frame field and tells you that the momentum density sits when you have a torsion flux, right? So now, just to be clear, we can compare this to what the analogous things in the quantum Hall effect, where we get the current, charge current, which does not carry this extra index, is perpendicular to the electric field, and the charge density is locked to the magnetic field, right? So in this case, the equations are the same, except I have this extra index sitting here, which basically tells me what the charge I'm transporting is, okay? So here, for electric field, we have one charge, the electric charge. In this case, the charge is momentum, and I have three different directions of momentum, P0, P1, P2, and this is telling you that different charges are being carried in these different directions. Okay. So we've already discussed the torsion magnetic field. I showed you in the first couple of slides that this curl of this frame field is actually equal to tells you where these dislocations sit. So any type of flux, any type of torsion magnetic flux is just proportional to the dislocation density of the system. This BA, the torsion magnetic field, is equal to the sort of sum over all these dislocation points multiplied by their Burgers vectors. Okay. So the A index here is matched by this Burgers vector index. And so wherever a dislocation sits, we get a torsion flux, and thus we should have a momentum density bound to this point. So how do we understand that? Okay, so like I said, this magnetic field is tied to dislocation density. Okay, so how do we understand that a torsion flux, namely a dislocation in the system with non-zero viscosity, gives you momentum density bound to it? Okay, so the one system we know which has a non-zero viscosity is the quantum Hall effect, which is this system here. And now I want to say if I insert dislocation, if I remove one set of atoms, one half plane of atom, half line of atoms from somewhere, why do I have a momentum density bound to that point? Okay, this is sort of trivial to see. Okay, so what you do is you sort of make a cut, remove half these atoms, but the edge follows the cut. Okay, so basically it's like you're pushing this edge into the bulk of your system. Okay, you're taking this edge and deforming it to the center by making a cut here on this region. So you see, as you go around this loop, the sort of the chiral state just bends around this cut, bends around this dislocation, and you find that the sort of momentum is just sort of sticking out here in the middle. Okay, the momentum here is a piece of momentum density due to the fact you have a piece of the chiral edge state sitting there in the middle of the system, and the amount of momentum stored there, you see, points in the direction of the Burgers vector of this dislocation. So the Burgers vector here points along this direction. You see the momentum of this chiral edge state also points along that direction. Okay. It should move. That's right. That's right. So, this is momentum density. Okay. So what that means is if you take something, it's like a yes, that's a, it's a very... How can what? So, I mean, it's a subtle point. It's like, so the chiral edge state, you can think about it as flowing, okay? But it's really only flowing if you drop a particle into it. It's like a river sitting there. You drop a particle into it, and it carries it around, okay? So what they're saying is that this... let's start to this. This... It's like a locked momentum density in the system. So if I drop a particle there, it will move. But the dislocation itself is not moving. I mean, the dislocation is actually a deformation of your lattice. And what I'm talking about is the electron fluid sitting on top of the lattice. And so what's sitting there is a piece of momentum waiting to be used. But there's a sort of something flowing there, but the dislocation is not moving itself. Okay, the lattice is locked. What I have is if I drop an electron at that point, the electron will move in the fluid. But the fluid is moving on to sort of some background torsional flux, basically. And so it's not the momentum of the crystal itself, it's the momentum of the electronic structure sitting on top in this case. And so if I drop an electron here, it's going to travel around like it's flowing down a river. But the dislocation is not going to move itself. It's the momentum density of the electronic part, not the crystalline gravity part.
You're not going to use it because it's always sitting. I mean, it's you can't use it up. I mean, it's not like you can't use it up. It's just sitting there. That's right.
So the energy with the electric current is not
the okay. So the analogy about the current is that if I do this type of thing. So imagine I do this. I take a flux line from outside the system and drag it into the center. Okay, what I'm doing. I take a flux line from outside, drag it in the center. Okay. What you're doing with that flux line is actually going to trap charge to it. So what's happening at this point, if this was a flux point, a magnetic flux, there would be charge trapped there, okay? Bound charge. Here you have charge bound there too, but the charge has an arrow associated with it, which is the direction of momentum sitting there. So instead of being a charge, so what that means is if you integrate over this region, you'll find momentum stored there. Just like if it was charge density, if I integrated over that region, I'd find charge stored there. But here I integrate over this region, I find momentum stored there. And you can see this because locally, if you integrate here, the momentum along this incoming line and this line cancel because they're going oppositely. Okay, but this local piece, if I don't integrate over this whole thing, just this small localized region here, I'm going to get a finite momentum bound to this point. Okay, so I'm basically creating momentum out of the vacuum. The other piece of momentum C sits here on this edge where I've kicked this whole system out. Okay, but this is just a charge which is bound to this torsion flux. The charge has an arrow, which is the momentum, and so you find some momentum density there. Okay.
Where you have the cut.
Yes.
Because you have a cut, somehow or another, the geometry is confused, going from one side of the cut to the other side of the cut. And
yeah,
can I think of it as if it's confused enough that I can think of those currents canceling in that region because of the confusion? Whereas if I go to the site where the defect is, and go on the inside side, there is no confusion because I'm now away from the location of the defect, and therefore I see a little.
All right, so that's exactly how I should think about it. That's right.
Bunch of currents.
That's exactly what you should think. So the point is exactly what you said, that along this line, the current is flowing this way, along the other side, flowing the other way, and these two things are matched together closely so they cancel. The only thing that doesn't cancel is this piece sticking out on the end. Okay.
Yeah.
The piece sticking out on the end has some momentum flowing in some direction. Okay.
So yeah, but what it means to say matched close together in the presence of a dislocation.
So this isn't
easy to describe in terms of the overall global geometry.
That's right. So this is definitely a heuristic picture. Okay.
Yeah.
In a real lattice, there's not going to be a cut. These bonds are actually going to be connected anyways. It's not going to be missing atoms. It's going to be connected. Okay.
But connected in a funny way.
In a funny way. And it's going to be, okay. So that connected in a funny way can effectively cancel all the stuff sitting here because these edge states are coupled. There's no, it's not like a real edge. They're actually coupled.
Right.
And you have this piece, this discontinuity of this piece sticking out in the end. Okay, and you can't create momentum of nothing, so actually the opposite momentum sits on the boundary, where you kick the other part of this. So you can imagine I take this whole system and shift a chunk of it out, right? And this other piece which is sitting out here has this other kink in it, which is the other part of the momentum which I take. Okay.
And so translational symmetry is broken at the site of dislocation. Can we still...
Yeah. So that's a great question. So the question is, why can you talk about momentum when translation symmetry is broken? Yeah. So this jump, so like I said, this picture is
heuristic in some sense. What you can do is you can actually attach this side to that side. You can glue these together into a cylinder so that it looks roughly translation branched along that direction. And you can actually define this dislocation in a weird way so that it is translation invariant in this case. This picture is not translation invariant, but this is a gauge choice type of thing. But yeah, so that's a great point. So in principle, so all that means though is there will be momentum sitting there, but it's not necessarily quantized. It can relax. So the momentum can disappear because it can scatter off other pieces, right? So, but that's very important to consider. Okay, electric charge is always conserved, right? You drag a fluxion system, the electric charge can't disappear, it's conserved. But momentum, if you have translation breaking, dislocations, inhomogeneities, whatever else, momentum can disappear. So this is a much more, I don't want to say fine-tuned, but it's definitely a subtle feature. You have to be careful about how the momentum is conserved. So you can draw a picture like this where momentum is conserved if you carefully insert the dislocation to show how this works. But this picture, you're right, does not translation vary in this direction.
And it's like a magnetic translation, but instead of picking up, so instead of your magnetic translations not commuting by a projective phase, they don't commute by a translation operator. It's a similar type of idea. And so, the real problem with torsion is that you want to do stuff in real space, but it depends on momentum. It depends on the charge of these particles. So you have to be very careful about how you speak about this, because what you want to do is you want to drag a particle around a point, but the amount it gets translated depends on its momentum. And if you want to have a really clean picture, you've got to carefully divide your geometry so that at least one component of momentum is conserved in some way. So there's some subtleties there of mixing between real space and momentum space, which are
Could you picture when you work in the momentum space or in the prime?
Yes, you can. You can have a picture of momentum space, which basically means that. But the problem is you can't do like a cycle. You can't drag something around a momentum defect. But there is a picture half the momentum space, half the real space, where you can do something like that, which is basically what you have to kind of think about anyways. Okay, so that was the torsion magnetic field, and especially the heuristic picture, and Sunset brought this good point about momentum conservation.
Now I want to ask about momentum, the electric response. So the electric field is a lot more difficult to imagine. Okay, the dislocation is a natural way to imagine magnetic flux. The torsion electric field is a lot more difficult to imagine. And so the only way I can come up with a good way to think about this is by inducing electric field through the Faraday effect, which means I want a changing magnetic flux. I know how to deal with magnetism in torsion. It's a dislocation. So what I want is a changing torsion magnetic field to generate a torsion electric field. And one way to do this is to simply take a flux line and drag it through my system. Okay? So I start off with a system here with no torsion magnetic field. I drag some torsion magnetic flux into the system, which deforms this thing here, and I keep carrying it in the system. So this is now a changing torsion flux, which is going to generate an electric field. All right? And so what this tells you, this response tells you, you get a momentum current traveling perpendicular to the electric field. Right? So when I actually drag my flux this way, my electric field is actually pointing perpendicular to the way I'm dragging it, okay? Because of the way the flux is changing. Right? Now the point is, what I start with is a chunk of a little bit of momentum sticking out on this point, and I'm actually carrying this bit of momentum from this side all the way to the other side, where it cancels out this edge state on the other side. It cancels out this piece sitting on this other side, right? So the momentum here is pointing up, momentum here is pointing down, and when they hit each other, they'll annihilate. So this is effectively like, heuristically, imagine cutting a hole in the system. You take this dislocation all the way across, it effectively splits your system into two pieces, okay? So again, this is a gauge-dependent picture, but it's heuristically how you can think about what's actually happening. So you're not really cutting it in half, but effectively you're sort of canceling out part of the edge state. And this is actually carrying, this is a momentum current because you're carrying momentum from one side to the other side, right? And in this case, you're carrying momentum which, so as it matches this, the Burgers vector of this dislocation. That's right. So basically the physical picture is that now you've created some weird structure here. We're on one side of this, one side of where you drag this through, you've got a momentum current sitting there. The other side, you have one as well. And so, but these things aren't really there because these leftover pieces, like BJ said, these leftover pieces, which are the remnants of this process, can't cancel. So what you're really doing is you're taking momentum all the way across and canceling a piece out on the other side, and this string in the middle can be annihilated basically if you do it correctly. So this leftover chunk that's the remnants of this process can be annihilated by just combining these edges together by coupling them. So this cut isn't really there. What I'm saying is there's actually connections between those two points which are still remaining. Okay. So there's actually a different way to generate electric fields, similar to what's called the Laughlin gauge argument in condensed matter. So you can imagine that if this is a quantum Hall system on a cylinder, so I have edge states here, edge states there, and I've attached it to some wall. Now, if you want to do a quantum Hall experiment, what you do is you thread magnetic flux through the hole of the cylinder. This creates an electric field tangential to the cylinder that's going to put a current along the line of this, along this axis of the cylinder. So you can create electric field by threading flux through the cylinder hole through the Faraday effect again. Right? So how do you do this with torsion? Basically, all you do is you twist the system. So what you want is you want the integral of the frame field around this loop to be non-zero. So what that means is you want to be translating, okay, as a function of time around the cylinder. So it means you twist the cylinder in some way, in this case non-uniformly, because I pin this thing to a wall and twist it in some way. So now if you twist it, what you're going to get is you're going to get momentum flowing along the axis of the cylinder from this side to this side. So this is a different way to get the torsion electric response. You take a system, you torque it, you twist it as a function of time, okay? There are special times when you twist it exactly by 2 pi, and in some sense when you've twisted exactly by 2 pi, one unit of momentum has been transferred across the system. This is the same thing as saying when you thread a magnetic flux, if you thread a full flux quantum, one unit of charge is transferred across the system. Okay. So the last thing I'm going to say about torsion for this... What's that?
So this is what you're doing.
That's, yeah, in some sense, you're right. You're shearing it this way. But in this case, if you actually, yeah, if you... Yeah, I have to think about the picture. It could be something like that. So the last thing I'm going to say about torsion is something that in 3 plus 1D, okay? So in 3 plus 1D, there's a term analogous to the gravitational Chern-Simons term, and there's a term analogous to the frame field Chern-Simons term, which is called the Ni-Yan term, okay? So all this Ni-Yan term is telling you in this context, so I take my massive fermions, 3 plus 1D, which is a 3 plus 1 dimensional top plus 1 set, which I did not discuss, but you can do the same thing, couple them to a frame field in the spin connection, integrate out the fermions, okay? And you'll get this gravitational term with some coefficients, but you also get this torsion term. And all this thing is telling you is that you get, on a domain wall of theta, you get a quantum Hall viscosity, okay? It's saying that when you have a domain wall of theta, you're left with this Chern-Simons term bound to the domain wall, right? This is the same picture as taking the axion term for electrodynamics, theta F wedge F, and saying that on every axion domain wall, every domain wall of theta, you get a Chern-Simons term bound to, which means you have a quantum Hall effect on the surface, okay? So for 3 plus 1 top watch insulators, we know, or we found that they are characterized by having a quantum Hall effect on the surface. Now, if they have a quantum Hall effect, naturally they're going to have a quantum Hall viscosity. They should go hand in hand. So the Ni-Yan term is telling you that basically the quantum Hall viscosity is also bound to the surface of a 3 plus 1 dimensional top watch insulator. So this gives you some way to talk about what would be called axion elasticity or something. It tells you that you get a torsion magnetoelectric effect in this topological insulator. And so again, the coefficient here has units of 1 over length squared, and it's connected with the mass of the bulk fermion. Okay. So there's one more piece to this torsion puzzle which hasn't been fully understood yet, and that's how all these terms relate to real physical anomalies in 3 plus 1D and 2 plus 1D. This is something we're working very hard on, but there's still some questions, so I'm not going to speak about that. But hopefully in the future, this will give some intuition about what's going on for field theory anomalies related to this Ni-Yan term.
Viscosity effects really been seen experimentally?
No, it's I mean,
the stuff is proposal to have to
No. The stuff is brand new, even in the quantum Hall viscosity. I mean, nobody's talked about the frame field stuff before, but even the idea of viscosity in quantum Hall is roughly new, and so nobody has come up with an experiment yet. Because there's also, this point Sung-Sik hit on is very important, because you have to really think about what happens when you include disorder and things like this. Because electric charge measurements don't care about disorder. Charge is charge. Disorder doesn't change that. But momentum is not conserved. It's like a gauge. I mean, when you break translation symmetry, your gauge charge is no longer conserved. And so this is an important consideration. So most likely, quantum Hall effect will have some number for the viscosity, but it won't necessarily be the number we calculated. It will be some other number. But it'll have a non-zero viscosity, but it will be difficult to get a quantized thing out of this, I think, a really quantized thing. But you can measure it, hopefully, by doing
rotation experiments on wheels.
To construct materials that, I don't know, are twisted in the way you're describing in the previous slides, and
yeah.
took a way to enhance torsion effects and suppress the other things and so on and so forth to try to really.
These are great questions. I think that the problem is you see what Langlands are talking about this, and I'm talking about in terms of fermions coupled to gravity. And so experimental sees that and thinks, okay, well, I'm not going to bother with this. And so I think it designing experiments, and in fact, the language I'm using now is much simpler than what's actually been done before. Actually, the previous literature is actually even more complicated, in my opinion. And so I think that it really would require to sit down with experimenters and say, you know, what can you do? What's possible? But it's possible that, the experiments I'm talking about here are real thought experiments, real, phenomenological. What you really do is you take the system, connect it to something that vibrates or something, and see how it shears and measure something from that, probably. But doing this real experiment where you glue this thing to the wall and twist it, that's not going to happen. But you can do shearing and straining to see what happens and maybe measure something indirectly, which tells you about what the viscosity is. You can't attach leads to it to measure it. That's the hard part. Okay. In the last 5 minutes, I'm going to talk about something completely different, which is also connected to torsion and condensed matter systems. This is something I worked on with Andy Randono, and it's a 3D+1-dimensional defect called a torsional monopole. And this defect is something which could be already apparent in condensed matter systems, but is not, but maybe hasn't been seen yet. Okay, so I'm going to give you first the heuristic picture, so that if you take nothing away, you can take this picture away. So I'm in 3D+1D. I imagine that every point in space-time I have some local frame, and I've represented this, or actually Andy had this nice picture, but I represent this by a globe in this system. Okay, so I have some origin, I've got a globe, and this is, for example, the z equals zero plane of this monopole structure. So this really should be three-dimensional. I should have a three-dimensional set of these globes, but I'm only going to draw the two-dimensional structure, right? So I'm beginning effectively in flat space in the first-order formalism. So like we've talked about all so far, I've got a frame field and spin connection. And I'm in flat space, I'm going to pick a gauge where the spin connection vanishes. And so this means that all the torsion is bound into the frame field. I'm only looking at the frames. The spin connection is not doing anything weird, right? So I can represent the whole monopole structure by just considering the deformation of the local frames. So what the monopole means is that if you start from the origin and travel out to infinity, your frame rotates about that axis, basically. So if I start here and I go to infinity, the frame rotates around the x-axis. If I start here and go to infinity, the frame rotates around the y-axis. If I start here and go to infinity along the diagonal, it rotates around the diagonal axis. So basically, this monopole is nothing but saying in your internal space, as you go from the center of the monopole out to infinity, your frame field rotates around the radial axis by 2 pi. Okay? So you can imagine this is a very simple closed type of system. Boundary conditions can be satisfied. It's rotating by one time around the whole system. So here at infinity, you see the frames are all matched up, but they rotate around different directions and depends radially. Okay? See?
This is the case of the z equals zero plane. This monopole is completely spatial.
Spatial.
That's right. So there's no transformation. It's complete, just pure rotation.
Pure rotation.
And this is three dimensions.
Three plus zero.
That's right. So what you really have is these things would really come out in the third dimension too and rotate around the axes in that dimension as well. So the center of the globe would rotate around the z axis and it comes out in the z direction. So this is just a projection of the z equals zero plane of this local frame structure. Okay? So this is the heuristic picture. You can see how this monopole might work if you've thought about monopoles or any type of topological defects before. There's some interesting things about this one which make it different from the typical ones you see, for example, in Yang-Mills theory.
So I'm going to briefly discuss the sort of mathematical construction because it's actually quite simple. And so what we want is a completely torsional defect. We don't want to have any curvature. I mean, we don't want to think about curvature in this case. We'd like it to be able to exist even when you have curvature, but I'm only going to give the arguments for flat space. If you want to see the curved space arguments, you can look at our paper or talk to me later. But the arguments are actually quite simple. Okay, so the ingredients we have are the frame field, the spin connection, and the Levi-Civita connection, which is compatible with the frame field. So what does that mean? It means if I take the covariant derivative of the frame field with respect to gamma, this Levi-Civita connection identically vanishes by definition. And if I take the derivative with respect to the spin connection, I get the torsion 2 form. So I'm allowed to have torsion. Okay, but this gamma connection is actually a separate connection, different from the spin connection, which is compatible with E. And in principle, E and omega are completely independent, so I can specify them independently. Right? So now I'm going to, since I'm in flat space and I have two connections, these things are always related by some relative gauge, effectively. So I can always write the spin connection in this form. okay, for some gauge function g, right? So what I have my Levi-Civita connection. It's not equal to the spin connection, but since I'm in flat space, it can be equal to a gauge transform of the Levi-Civita connection, right? Okay, so what this implies that the curvature of the spin connection is just the gauge covariant transformation of the curvature of the Levi-Civita connection. They're connected by a gauge transformation, this relative gauge transformation, and it means the curvature is satisfied this property. Okay, so now I'm going to define a topological charge, okay? And the topological charge is going to be the difference between... Assuming... Yeah, that's right. So yeah, so I'm going to... Yeah, so... yeah. So the, so exactly. So they can both... In this case, for flat space, they both vanish. That's right. Exactly. Huh? That's right. So
in fact, you could pick gamma to be zero in flat space. And so omega is just this gauge function. And gamma is zero. That's right.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, so it turns out the argument's a little more complicated in curved space, but the math is still simple. So I'll get the arguments with full R's in it. And then the point is that this equation here is a little bit more difficult. Saying that
omega is just a gauge transform of the Levi-Civita connection is a little bit more complicated if you think about curved space, not flat space.
So this is going to be a large gauge transformation.
Yeah, that's fine.
There should be any delta singularity
in
any delta function like singularity?
It's
zero everywhere, but at the center.
In this case, the curvature should identically vanish. I don't think that. This large gauge transformation. Okay, so I'm going to define this topological current. Okay, and the current is very simple. It's just the difference of the two Chern-Simons terms for the two connections, omega and gamma. Okay,
and so if gamma vanishes in flat space, then this is just the connection for this is just the Chern-Simons term for omega. And we can see this current is conserved because if I take the exterior derivative, so this is the dual of the current. So if I take the exterior derivative, the Hodge dual. I get this is just R omega, which R omega, minus R gamma, which R gamma, which vanishes in flat space identically because all the curvatures vanish. But even if I have this relation I talked about earlier where they're related by a gauge transformation, where they're not vanishing, this thing is still zero, okay? So what I have is this current, the difference is the sort of the relative, it tells you the difference between these two Chern-Simons terms, which is some kind of relative gauge between omega and gamma, right? So this current is conserved, and above and beyond that is topologically stable because for this case, the current's actually equal to this charge is actually equal to this winding number. Okay, so if I define the charge, I get some topologically stable charge, which is quantized because this gauge function can be mapped, it can be thought of as a map between our Euclidean real space into the gauge group spin 3-1, which has a compact piece, which is the rotational component, which gives you an integer. Okay, so basically what I'm talking about is we're talking about real space, which is being mapped into the space of rotations, local rotations of these frames. So this gives me some kind of quantized charge, right? So you see these type of functions all the time in Yang-Mills theory. I'm going to show you in a minute, or I can tell you in a minute why this is a little bit different. So the first thing is that this charge, you can easily find a configuration which has non-zero charge. And this is the sort of same type of topological charge form you'd see in Yang-Mills theory for the instanton structure, things like that. And so you can write down this gauge function, plug it in this formula, do the integral over your real space manifold to get the charge, you find out it's quantized to be 1 in this case, right? So as I mentioned before, this is different than what you see in Yang-Mills theory because let's go back to the current. If you do a gauge transformation in Yang-Mills theory, global gauge transformation, which has a different winding number, you can actually change the topological charge of these monopoles. Okay. The point is that here, instead of changing the topological charge, what you're doing is you actually have a difference of two Chern-Simons functionals. And so since they change the same way under the gauge transformation, the change actually cancels out in this case. So actually this charge is gauge invariant in this sense because we've defined it precisely as the difference between the two Chern-Simons functionals. So the global gauge transformation does not affect the charge at all. The differences cancel out in this case. Okay, so how might these be interesting in condensed matter systems? So if we take the gauge, like I showed earlier, that the spin connection vanishes and I'm only left with the frame field, then I can imagine this frame field is simply the orientation of local orbitals in some system. So I have some, imagine some 1D system, and I have, you know, some local p orbitals, and they're bending around as I travel in space. Okay, so you imagine you have some underlying lattice. This is an example of some kind of one plus one dimensional frame field kink. It's not the monopole, but it's just a drug in this case. And you can see that we didn't have to deform the lattice at all to do this kink. You sort of deform the local degree of freedom, the local orbital orientation. Okay. So we see that if you try to solve the Schrodinger equation with these p orbitals, where you just have free fermions with no spin, or with spin but not a couple to the orbital structure, they don't even feel the torsional defect, because the metric is actually doesn't depend on the monopole at all. So if you actually calculate the metric of this torsional monopole, it's actually equal to the metric. It's actually equal to the sort of flat space metric. So the monopole is actually a complete internal rotation. It doesn't affect the strain, doesn't affect the metric at all. It's a complete internal structure. And so normal electrons, free fermion Schrodinger electrons, can't see the monopole at all. So they'll travel right through it without even being affected. Okay. But the point is that if you have spin orbit coupling, the situation is different. So one example of a system with spin orbit coupling is just the Dirac equation, which has this topological insulator. Okay. In this case, P actually couples to the frame field, not the metric. So in this case, what's happening is that the particles traveling through this monopole will get their spin rotated along with their traveling. Okay. And so you imagine if you have a particle carrying a spin 1/2 as it passes through the monopole, its spin gets rotated by 2 pi. So if you have a spin 1/2 particle, that means it picks up a minus sign in this case. So it can be affected. So the Dirac equation is not the only equation you can have, the only Hamiltonian you can have. There's an example of many, many semiconductors in 3 plus 1 dimensions described by the so-called Luttinger model, which is a model of spin 3/2 particles. But here the Hamiltonian is quadratic in momentum. Instead of being linear, it's actually quadratic. These type of Hamiltonians will also see the frame field because it has spin coupled to momentum. Okay, so you would imagine that torsion defects are have a chance to sort of affect systems which have a spin orbit coupling, because these systems actually feel the rotation.
You're saying this the two frame boundaries are not the same boundary, with torsion and without torsion. What is geometrically what's different? What's different with and without torsion?
I mean,
the manifold sense is the same.
That's right. The manifold is the same. In fact, the metric is the same.
Yeah.
The only thing that's changing is basically your local point has its internal frame rotated.
Right. The frame is rotating.
The frame is rotating, but nothing. It's not rotating.
But
it's changing in a way
to give you the frame boundary. You have two different frame boundaries, if you like.
That's right.
I guess that's what it is.
That's right. So as you have this internal rotation degree of freedom, which tells you that your local particle sees some frame, it's rotating as a function of position.
Right.
And so the monopole structure doesn't even enter the metric. You can calculate it. There's no change in the metric due to the monopole charge or anything like that. It doesn't even enter the metric.
But locally, I can rotate it back so that two locally they're the same. It's just globally you cannot do it.
Locally you can do it back, but that probably puts effects in spin connection as well, right? Locally, you rotate it back into a local case of spin, that's probably going to give you non-zero spin connection. Right? So all the monopole structures probably contain then possibly the spin connection. Locally, you can rotate it back, but I think that will probably give you a contribution to spin connection that still gives you the torsion. So the simplest picture to draw are when the spin connection vanishes and all everything's in the frame field. For me, at least, that's the easiest thing to draw. Because then I'm really talking about translation, not about anyways. So it turns out a good place to look at these defects would be in topological insulators or in other spin-orbit coupled semiconductors. And you can see there's some simple effects you can imagine where if you start with an electron at the center of the monopole and drag it outward, its spin's going to rotate by 2 pi, so this means it picks up a minus sign. Okay, so traveling from inside to outside, you can have some interference effects by particles which pass through monopoles or particles which don't pass through these structures because the spin gets rotated by some amount. Right, so that's all I wanted to say. So these are some examples of how torsion could possibly interfere against matter. I think the two most outstanding questions which still remain along these lines are, first, figuring out realistic proposals to measure viscosity in monopoles, which is not a trivial thing. The second thing, which I think is a deeper question that people even in hydrogen are interested in, is how to understand microscopically how the torsion contributes to anomalies, whether it be 1 plus 1 dimensional chiral anomalies, 3 plus 1 dimensional chiral anomalies. Because there's this issue of this link scale which enters in the anomaly structure. And this link scale, although we interpret it as some kind of viscosity, it's not clear what the topological nature of this thing is. It almost seems like there's a topological piece multiplied by a scale, but it's not clear what that actually means. And so the anomaly structure, how to understand that in terms of things like index theorems or anything else, is still like a wide open question, I think. Anyways, thank you. Yes.
abstract to the ceiling. But when you introduce like the up plane is missing, we already break the translation invariance. So how can you talk at all about the momentum?
Right. So that, the point is that that picture I mean, the lattice itself already breaks transition symmetry. Okay. So you've already broken transition symmetry at the lattice level. You've gone from continuous transition symmetry to now being
circuit. We can talk about quasi momentum.
That's right. So now, in this case, it breaks translation. But there's ways you can arrange this location so that it keeps translation and bring it along one direction, for example. Okay. In these special cases, you can imagine having this momentum structure. But I mean, the having translation in this sense only gives you an easy way to pick out what happens when you do when you drag a particle out of this location. If you have translation symmetry, you drag a particle out of this location, you get multiplied by phase if you have translation, because it's a momentum eigenstate. If it's not, it gets multiplied by translation in this case. So that part's not screwed up. Now the question is, can you talk about momentum transport when you have dislocations and things like this? And so the issue is that what I've drawn here is it's like saying, let me pick a gauge for a uniform magnetic field. Okay, I pick a gauge, the Landau gauge, which is this, right? So let me write down a two-point system with a uniform magnetic field, right? So physically, there's no transition symmetry breaking, right? Let me pick a gauge. AX equals minus BY, right? So the curl of this thing gives you uniform B in the Z direction. But I broke the transition symmetry because now it depends on the Y direction. That's a gauge choice. So all the pictures I'm drawing are similar. The dislocation pictures I'm drawing are really a gauge choice because you have this underlying translational gauge freedom to do something there. So some of what you say, some part of the question you ask is definitely relevant. There's other parts that are masked by the sort of gauge choice that I've chosen to draw these pictures in. And so it's an idea similar to this that you can choose a gauge which breaks this physics and so independent of that, basically. But those kind of questions are extremely subtle, and it's not clear. They're not clear. I don't have a great answer for that overall.
Questions? Let's spend a little bit.